Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with William Giroux, author of The Matthews Men, Seven Brothers, and The War Against Hitler's U-Boats. We'll also hear from Michael Murphy, who's the author of Hear Dat New Orleans, a guide to the rich musical heritage and lively current scene. In his new book, The Matthews Men, Seven Brothers, and The War Against Hitler's U-Boats, William Giroux draws on his background as a veteran reporter for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, some 25 years, and his work for the Maersk Shipping Company. It's a war story, of course, filled with high seas adventure and the terrible cost of war to one small place, Matthews County, Virginia. William Giroux, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Now, this book has been percolating in your mind for almost 20 years. First, you covered a forum in which old-timers reminisced about merchant ships torpedoed off the coast of Virginia Beach. And then you found something in an archive in 2011 that really focused your search, right?
That's correct. Yeah, somebody say something about the speed that I work at. But yeah, I was a newspaper reporter in 1991 looking for something to write about one day, and I wandered into a speaker's forum down at Virginia Beach where I live, and a gentleman in his 70s talked about being out on the beach one sunny day and looking up to see a couple of American tankers explode right off the beach, you know, close enough that he could smell the oil leaking out of the storage tanks. And I was just stunned by this. I had read a lot about World War II growing up, but I had always thought it was something that happened at the other side of this ocean, the other side of that ocean. And I was thinking, you know, what was a U-boat doing skulking around at my beach, you know, where I was swim with my family? So I just started reading everything I could read, and I was fascinated by the story. And what really interested me was the experience of the merchant mariners on these cargo ships that kept getting torpedoed, and then they'd go back out and get torpedoed again. And, you know, what they and their families went through. And I was looking for a book that I really would tell their story. And I couldn't really find the book that I wanted to read. And I began thinking, well, maybe I could write a book like this. But I wanted to focus on a group of people, you know, that I could follow through the experience, that I could sort of get to know and present. And nothing came to mind. And I had a day job and a family. I just sort of put it in the back of my mind. I thought, well, maybe someday I'll stumble across something. And I, 20 years later, in 2011, I was in the Norfolk Library one day, just sort of wandering around, and I picked up a dusty book, and this book was literally gathering dust. And it was A Yachtsman's Guide to the Chesapeake Bay, and it had just a little historical note in it that said, during World War II, a large number of mariners from Matthews were sailed against the U-boats and were torpedoed. And I just looked at this paragraph, and it just hit me like a bolt of lightning. I thought, this is how to tell this story. And yeah. Part of the reason I felt that way is that I knew Matthews. I had once lived there early, you know, years before, and not for a long time, but I knew what an unusual place it was and is. It's a beautiful place, but it's a tiny place. It's kind of isolated. It's right out on the edge of the Chesapeake Bay. And everybody I met when I lived there had some connection to the water. They were fishermen or mariners, or they were yachtsmen or retired Navy officers. And everybody in Matthews knew everybody else. And I thought, you know, if there's one place you could go to reconstruct a 70-year-old war story that has kind of been forgotten, it's Matthews. So I started going there on my days off with a little list of people to talk to. And everybody I talked to referred me to other people. They said, yeah, go down on the creek here and talk to my uncle. You know, he got torpedoed. Or talk to this guy. His father was killed by a U-boat.
Wow.
And I kept finding more people and finding more stories, and that's kind of how the book came together.
You know, these seagoing families and the seven brothers you focus on, these families really trusted you with their stories, not just of war, but of family life as well.
They did. You know, going down there, I'd never written a book before, and these people that I would call up, they didn't have any real reason to believe anything would even come of this. But again and again, they would invite me into their homes, and they would talk with me, and they'd tell me things. And you know, at first, not so much, but as I got to know them a little bit more, and they would dig stuff out of attics and trunks and everything, you know, letters and photographs and records and everything. You know, a lot of the men that were still alive, the men that had sailed against the U-boats, were just sort of puzzled and maybe bemused that somebody was asking them these questions, because nobody had really shown a lot of interest in this outside their own families. But they were unfailingly very humble. You know, you had to drag information out of some of them. And that's true with a lot of men in the military who were in World War II. They don't come home and talk about it, or they didn't.
Well, all I could think about reading this book was that you must be a really terrific listener. You know?
I was a reporter for a long time.
That's right. Those skills come in handy. But one of the things you do especially well is tell the stories of the women. And there are so many courageous women in this story, especially Henny. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about her.
Yes, Henny Hodges is one of my favorite characters in the book. And everybody that is still left in the Hodges family just talks about her. And she was really, obviously not a mariner, but she was the glue that held this Hodges family together. She worked day and night, pretty much every day of her life, not only to rear this family that her husband, the tugboat captain, kept adding to every time he came home, but then leaving her to deal with. But she also ran the Hodges' 60-acre farm, and the farm was located on a remote point of land in Matthews, and the farm was really an outpost of an outpost. It had no electricity, running water, indoor plumbing. It had no radio, no telephone. Everything there had to be done the old-fashioned way, and Henny was pretty much in charge of it. And her children and grandchildren thought she was superhuman. One of her grandsons told me that when he was growing up, he honestly believed that if he had accidentally cut his arm off, that Henny could have fixed it. But she was given to these crying spells. Several times a day, she would break down in tears and just start sobbing, you know, without any real apparent provocation. And this puzzled her family, but really, she had a lot of sorrows in her life, and these just seemed to bubble up. And she would throw herself back into her work until the feeling passed. And unfortunately, the U-boat war would provide her with more sorrow.
Absolutely. Well, you really capture the texture of this family life. That's such a pleasure to read and so moving. Another one of the things that comes home in this book is the intimacy of this kind of warfare, that the fact that U-boat commanders would help men into ships, would sometimes make sure they had supplies, give them directions in some instances. That I found absolutely fascinating.
To me, that was certainly one of the most surprising things that I encountered in doing the research, because there were incident after incident of this. And the U-boat commanders, I mean, they were absolutely dedicated to sinking these guys' ships. That's what they were there for. But when men would survive a sinking, they'd be helpless out there on a lifeboat or a raft. Not all the U-boat commanders were this way. Some of them would just point a machine gun at them and interrogate them. But there were some, and you can follow in the report, some of the certain U-boat commanders did this routinely. They couldn't bear to just leave them out there to die, you know, in the middle of the ocean. A lot of times the torpedoings took place hundreds of miles from land or so far away that, you know, in bad weather and winter time, and you were leaving them to die. And some of these guys, they just couldn't do that. And they were told, Hitler had made it clear that they were supposed to kill them. You know, he wanted them to machine gun them in the lifeboats, because that was part of, you know, if they could eliminate ships and mariners, they would be that much closer to cutting the Allies' supply line. And even the head of the U-boat command, Admiral Carl Dönitz, kept telling them, do not help these guys. You know, you don't have to machine gun them, but don't help them. But the U-boat commanders, you know, they're thousands of miles from Hitler, and they're in command of their own ships, and they've got consciences. And some of them just couldn't bring themselves to do this, so they would offer them stuff. And my favorite example is one of the Matthews men is in a lifeboat after his ship is torpedoed, and the U-boat commander approaches and, first of all, apologizes for having sunk their ship. And he offers them food. He offers them 40 packages of cigarettes and some French cookies, because the U-boat was based in occupied France. And he gives them a big 10-gallon jug of water, and before he hands over the water jug, he squeezes fresh limes into it to introduce vitamin D to fortify these men against scurvy in the event their lifeboat has to be at sea for a long time. And as he's leaving, he calls out to the men, he said, come over and see me in Germany after the war, you know, after this is all over. But again, I don't mean to suggest that this was kind of a chummy thing. It was a brutal war, and these examples, there were a number of them, but they were on balance, they were the exceptions rather than the rule.
Well, what happened afterwards to the people in the lifeboats was pretty grueling. I mean, you tell these stories of men who lost their minds and people who, of course, were lost just, you know, at the very last minute. And you even tell the story of a lifeboat baby, which I found fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a phenomenal story. It's a baby born in a lifeboat at sea after his mother's ship was torpedoed in a storm off Cape Hatteras. And the baby somehow survives this, and ultimately the people in the lifeboat are rescued by an American destroyer called the USS Jesse Roper. And the mother, who is a refugee from the war from Yugoslavia, names the child Jesse Roper Mohorovicic, the family's last name. And Jesse, who I was able to find and interviewed, went on to become an executive in a shipping company. In fact, a shipping company that was ultimately bought out by Maersk, one of my old employers. So it's just a very great story. And just, I had actually met Jesse without knowing he was a lifeboat baby. I had interviewed him, you know, for a newspaper story about the Merchant Marine, you know, years before I wrote the book. So the whole thing was just a very unusual experience for me.
Coming full circle. Now, one of the other things that comes home in this book is how unrecognized these merchant mariners' contribution to the war efforts remains today. You're hoping that your book will play a part in changing that, aren't you?
I'd like to think so. There have been efforts in Congress for years, and there are some going on now, to reach out to these guys and either give them honorary veteran status or give them some money or something. But, you know, these efforts never really seem to go anywhere. And sad to say, they're rapidly becoming moot because these men are in their late 80s, early 90s. And honestly, the Matthews men that I talked to, I'm not sure any of them, or hardly any of them, even knew that these efforts were going on. They long ago stopped expecting the government to come back and say, yeah, we're sorry, we should have done better by you, here's something. What they did tell me is they would kind of like somebody to know what they did. They like a little bit of credit. You know, they're not part of the American narrative of how we won the war. And one guy told me, he said, you know, maybe when your book comes out, my grandkids will finally believe that I did something useful during the war. Maybe that's a reasonable hope. You know, who knows what Congress will do.
Well, all I can say is you have served these guys well. This is an amazing story. We've been talking with William Giroux, whose new book is The Matthews Men, Seven Brothers and the War Against Hitler's U-Boats. You can meet him Monday, May 2nd at 6 at Octavia Books. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Michael Murphy has made it his business to celebrate New Orleans. In Eat Dat 1 and 2, his guides to our food scene. In Fear Dat, his guide to our subculture of death, cemeteries, and dark arts. And now in Hear Dat, our music. He guides both locals and tourists to great New Orleans experiences. Michael, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Well, it's good to be back in The Reading Life.
So how long did it take you to write this book? Because it's so comprehensive.
Well, I'm crazy. Eat Dat I wrote in 2 months.
Wow.
And gained 12 pounds. Drove myself crazy. On Hear Dat, the publisher actually wanted to give me flexibility. This book is supposed to come out next fall. But I insisted and made it very difficult for their lives. You got to get out there for Jazz Fest.
Absolutely.
So I put this incredible schedule. This book I wrote in 3 months.
Whoa. So how much time did you spend listening to music? Or were you drawing on, you know, the years of listening to
both,
New Orleans
both.
Music?
Same with Eat Dat. I mean, it says over 250 restaurants on the cover. We lie. It's about 205.
Only 12 pounds.
Yes.
That's a miracle.
A lot of those I had been to before. Like in writing the book, I did not go back to Galatoire. I've already been there 28 times.
Yeah.
Same here. You know, I saw Michia Lake a good 10 times before I ever moved to New Orleans. She's fabulous. It's there. The Bingo Show I've been to 3 times before I ever lived here. So a lot of it was drawing upon my past, and others were dipping around. There are artists in here, because there are so many, that frankly it was CDs and YouTube. I did not, shameful. Some people in here I did not see personally in the flesh, but most I did.
Well.
You do what you can.
It's a lot. You packed in a lot. That's all I can say. It's so much fun, this book. It's so lively. Your prose style is so funny and energetic and opinionated. And that's what people want.
This one, honestly, was a little hard for me to write that way, because I do want my style to be a bit irreverent, I used to say my books are sort of, they're not as well written, they're not as knowledgeable as Lafcadio Hearn's, but as though written by Dave Barry. Different style. And Eat That was easy. Just open vein and flow. You can write very animated about our restaurants and, you know, voodoo, vampires, graveyards, and ghosts. You're supposed to make fun of some of these stories and have fun with it. Not so with musicians. I felt really kind of the weight on my shoulders a little bit because you can't make fun of a performer on stage unless it's Vince Vance. You know, people who want to make fun of him. But mostly, this book required more sincerity than I'm used to. So it was actually the hardest book I've written so far.
But you are sincere in your love of New Orleans
music.
Oh,
that's no question about that.
Absolutely.
More than love, I call myself an apostle.
That's pretty serious love, honey. So you've devoted each of these chapters to a particular type of music. And I'm curious, what's dearest to your heart?
Mine? It's actually chapter 11.
Which is?
Discordant notes.
I knew that!
Where it doesn't really fit a category. Like, Helen Gillet brings me to tears.
I know, isn't she marvelous?
She's amazing. And she plays the cello and does a little French folk music, etc. As well as that incredible looping she does. Because it's not gimmicky. It's just stunning. Mm-hmm. And the Bingo Show, to me, is New Orleans. It's such, I say it's sort of New Orleans' twisted version of Cirque du Soleil. There's all this stuff going on in the performances. Debauch, which calls themselves a Russian mafia band. I love these side tangents in our music. I mean, I love our traditional jazz and blues, but those weird little side trails really turn me on.
Mm-hmm. You've always loved the Bingo Show, I know. So what kind of music is most removed from your personal taste that you're writing about?
That's tough because, you know, while you might say bounce, I actually love Big Freedia and bounce music.
Oh, God, I know.
The others, you know, rock and roll is kind of not my ballywick. Here, it is elsewhere, but here, not what, unless you call galactic rock and roll, and I don't know what you call them, they're my favorite group on the planet. Mm-hmm. They've replaced Talking Heads as my all-time number one favorite. But a lot of the rock groups are not what's called sludge rock here in New Orleans, a slight, underknown, people don't know about it movement, which lasted about 3 years. That's less me, but it is an important part of our history, so that's in there too.
Yeah. Well, you have to cover the waterfront no matter what it is
you listen to
in your car. So. Now, one of the chapters I love, besides discordant music, which I adored as well, is the chapter on divas and crooners.
Well,
I love that chapter. So many great characters.
We have so many wonderful singers here. I mean, so many. Irma Thomas is our goddess of voices, but
absolutely,
I love Ingrid Lucia. When you close your eyes, you swear it's Billie Holiday. And Michia Lake, when people come here visiting me from Ohio, Indiana, wherever, I try and get them to Michia Lake and watch their mouths drop open because she's such a vocalist and performer.
And Alan Toussaint is really the guiding presence of this book.
Absolutely.
Which I found so lovely. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about your feelings for him. And
it put me in pure panic because actually for Feared At, Anne Rice did the Forewarned. And
yeah, I love that.
I wanted a signature musician. To me, at the time, no one represented New Orleans' broad scope than Alan Toussaint. And I reached him through his brother. He agreed to do this question and answer forward, which we did. And then this book was already manuscript, was in with the publisher when he passed away in Spain. And I was feeling panic. I called my editor saying, please tell me it hasn't been set to go to press. Because if we don't address this, we're going to look really either uninformed or extremely callous.
Right.
So we did have the opportunity. I changed a dedication, made it to him. I put a little footnote after his Q&A answers about his passing, what he means to us, which is a lot. So he is kind of the overlord of this book. Sort of, he's in all the pages because he was such a generous soul.
And such an elder statesman for the whole scene. Always gracious, always lovely. So I thought that was very, very moving to see. And then at the end, you have the song list. I want you to talk a little bit about putting these definitives lists together.
And that, too, was harder than Eat That. At the back of Eat That, I went on to all the so-called food experts, people known for it. You know, the Poppy Tookers, the Sarah Rones, the Ian McNulty's, and they all contributed their lists of best places to get barbecue or jazz brunch, etc. I wanted something here the same for juke joints, you know, live musicians, historic musicians, and the top 50 songs. It was really tough reeling in these people. Some didn't want to be known. Some didn't want to contribute. I did get about 8 to 10, and from then I went to some websites listing it just to make it a little more full. So I did not list their names. Because I didn't want those people having to defend these decisions. How dare this song not be on the list? Or how could this be number 4 and that be number 28? I didn't want to expose them to that. So the list is there without names attached. So if you want to argue with it, argue with me.
But it's a fun list.
Oh, yeah.
And I think people love that. They love the give and take of it and what their personal pantheon consists of, you know?
Lists are everything. You make a list just to have people argue with you. You know, how could you leave that off? I mean, I get this. I don't know if it's a female trait as well. It's definitely a male trait. You rate your top 10 quarterbacks, people are going to get really angry that you left Autogram off the list, et cetera. And they'll fight for it for months on air and postings, et cetera.
Well, that's what you want to do. Stir up a good fight over this musical list. So tell me, what's your idea of a perfect musical experience in New Orleans?
Setting and who's playing. I mean, because like we mentioned Helen Gillet. Mm-hmm. At the Dewdrop Jazz Hall, it's breathtaking, this old country church. I go a lot to see her at Bacchanal, and I always get really angry. Because everyone's there eating, clinking their glasses, talking. I said, you have no knowledge. There's an artist right in front of you. How dare you be talking about whatever your concerns are of the day? So honestly, I love the discovery of new. Some musician I didn't know before, that's probably top of the list, like Jazz Fest, which is going on right now. Maybe this air is already on. And I used to say before I lived here, I'd come down from New York, pay my $20 back then. I miss those days. My first day, I saw Lenny Kravitz, Lyle Lovett, and John Hyatt. Same day, $20. And I say, and they were nowhere near the highlight. It's those groups you had never heard of, you know. Bootsy Jones and the Sunspots, that's not a real group, but you know, these people you did know that are from New Orleans that are jaw-droppingly wonderful. So I'm doing Jazz Fest this year, the first Friday, second Thursday, and I look forward to people I don't know, and that's what really makes it so rich, because there's so much creativity here.
There's
so
always
much talent.
Something to discover. It's just amazing to me that it never ends. You know, we're so lucky. So what's coming next from you? I know you're working on something very, very special for 2018, our anniversary.
Well, it has a little bit of a history there. The Dat books have done really well for Norton. My editor approached me to do Drink Dat, about our cocktail history and our current bar scene. And I'm really not that knowledgeable there. But I said, but I do know Elizabeth Pierce, who's brilliant. She's a brilliant personality. She gives cocktail tours. She's been on the Travel Channel. She has a blog site that I think she's letting go a little bit. But she knows our alcoholic history better than anyone. So I connected the two of them. And then I said, if you really want more Dat books, our city has a fabulous sexual history from Storyville through Bourbon's various evolutions and de-evolutions, neo-burlesque, where you can now, Thursdays, you can have burlesque lessons with Bella Blue, if you don't, at the Healing Center. And I suggested I would gladly write, and I won't use the word on air.
You can.
But blank that, and they turned me down. I was depressed. But then we did agree for 2018, which is our 300th anniversary, let's do this massive, over 200,000-word doorstop of a book, kind of like a silly Ken Burns book, about everything New Orleans. And every chapter is an active verb, because as I say to them and in my introduction, New Orleans is not a bucket list city. Don't bring your bucket list here. This city will wash over you and lead you in different directions. There's that great Paul Prudhomme quote, New Orleans will nudge you in the direction you were meant to go.
Right.
And we're a city about participating. You don't watch a parade from the curb, you join the parade. So each chapter is eating, drinking, exploring, fitting in, etc. Chapter 8 will be bonking, so I can get Norma Wallace in there, because she deserves to be on paper, which obviously she was with Chris Wilt's brilliant book.
The Last Madam, yes.
And Josie Arlington, and we just have great stories there. So it will be everything New Orleans, active verbs, a grand overview, massive book. And my favorite part, again, is the appendix.
Oh.
The 300 best things ever said by or about New Orleans. And finding these quotes, there's so many. Do you know the Angus Lind one from his old column? If you die of old age in New Orleans, it's your own damn fault.
So true. So we can watch for all that coming
next.
That'll
be probably like December 2017. It's a ways down the road a bit.
Sweet.
And then I'm done. I'm sure you're aware of this, being a member of Muses. Last year, one of the floats had a blow up on my cover, Eat That, along with all the ubiquitous Dat phrases, you know, scoop that, don't trash that, repeat that, etc. And the float was called Enough of Dat. And my feeling was, I'm not insulted. My feeling was True Dat. True Dat. I've done enough Dat books. We'll go on to other things.
Oh, well, we've been talking with Michael True Dat Murphy. His new book is Hear Dat. You can meet him when he signs at the Jazz Fest book tent. That's next to the CD tent. Thursday, April 28th from noon to 1. Michael, thanks so much.
Well, thanks again.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Howard Bloom discusses and signs The Last Good Night, a World War II story, of Espionage, Adventure, and Betrayal. Tuesday, April 26th at 6 at the U.S. Freedom Pavilion, National World War II Museum. Leon Morris signs Homage New Orleans Wednesday, April 27th at 6 at Octavia Books. Darlene Finch Kuhn discusses and signs her book, Sewing Holes, Wednesday, April 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Bill Lavender and Addie Sitchens are the featured readers in the Blood Jet Poetry Series, Wednesday, April 27th at 8 at BJ's in the Bywater. Professor James Shapiro of Columbia University presents the 27th Annual Josephine Gessner Ferguson Lecture, Shakespeare in America, Thursday, April 28th at 6 at the Freeman Auditorium, Woldenberg Art Center, Tulane University. Louisiana poet laureate Peter Cooley discusses the importance of poetry, Thursday, April 28th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, William Giroux, discusses and signs The Matthews Men, Seven Brothers, and the War Against Hitler's U-Boats, Monday, May 2nd at 6 at Octavia Books. Claudia Gray signs her Star Wars novel, Bloodline, Tuesday, May 3rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Julia Reed signs Julia Reed's South, Spirited, Entertaining, and High Style Fun all year long, Tuesday, May 3rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Carolyn Hembry, author of How to Rig Your Chevy into a Time Machine and Other Ways to Escape a Plague, appears Tuesday, May 3rd at 7 at the Collins Hotel as part of the 1718 Reading Series. The New Orleans Gulf South Booksellers Association is sponsoring the Jazz Fest Book Tent this weekend. Check out these authors who will be appearing at the tent, which is next to the CD tent. And remember, proceeds benefit New Orleans literacy organizations. Thursday, April 28th, from noon to 1, today's guest, Michael Murphy, signs Here Dat. Richard Campanella signs Photojournalism of Del Hall from 2 to 3. Cheryl Gerber signs New Orleans Life and Death in the Big Easy from 3 to 4. John Pope signs Getting Off at Elysian Fields from 4 to 5. And Alexis Brode signs Parade from 5 to 6. On April 29th, Friday, Johnny Goldstein and Michael Lydon sign Elegy of the Lost City from 12 to 1. Elvis Costello signs Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink from 1 to 2. Laura Cayuette signs Secret of the Other Mother from 2 to 3. Roger Hahn signs Sounds of Louisiana from 3 to 4. On Saturday, April 30th, Todd Mouton signs Way Down in Louisiana from noon to 1. Mary Milan, Bloody Mary, signs Bloody Mary's Guide to Hauntings, Horrors, and Dancing with the Dead, True Stories from the Voodoo Queen of New Orleans from 1 to 2. Tom Piazza signs Free State from 3 to 4. Poppy Tooker signs Two Jacques Cookbook, Creole Recipes and Lore in the New Orleans Grand Tradition from 4 to 5. Leif Peterson signs Swamp Kids, A Dog Named Cat from 5 to 6. On May 1st, Sunday, Big Frida signs Big Frida, God Save the Queen Diva from 2 to 3. Ryan Fertel signs his new book, One True Barbecue, Fire, Smoke, and the Pitmasters Who Cook the Whole Hog from 3 to 4. And Johnette Downing signs Louisiana, Jewel of the Deep South from 4 to 5. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.